Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem. In this show, we'll examine the stuff of outer space nightmares. Later on, we'll talk to Paul Chodas, the head of the Center for Near-Earth Object Studies, based at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, about a recent simulation study of how the Earth could react to an imminent collision with an asteroid large enough to cause devastation on a regional scale. But first, we'll visit with David Grinspoon about NASA's newly funded missions to return to the planet Venus after a decades-long hiatus. David is an astrobiologist at the Planetary Science Institute and a member of the Da Vinci Plus team, one of the two new missions that also includes Veritas. We'll let David, a longtime friend of the show, break down the acronyms and the missions, and why Venus is once again in the spotlight. He joined us recently from Washington, D.C. to talk about the hottest world in the solar system and one that he's had a long-term passion for. David Grinspoon, welcome to Blue Dot.
Oh, thanks very much. I appreciate it, and it's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Dr. Funky Spoon. It's always cool to have you. Okay, let's turn back the clock, and we'll talk about Da Vinci Plus in a bit. But when did you personally first get really interested in Venus? Because I know this has been a long-term passion for you.
Yeah, well, you know, I was kind of your classic child space nerd. So, in terms of being fascinated with space and the solar system, it really does go back to being a kid and seeing Apollo lift off and, you know, all that early inspiration. And then Venus in particular, I think I got the bug actually when I was an undergraduate college student, and I got a summer job doing research with one of my professors who was a planetary scientist who was working on the data from what was then a new mission to Venus, which was the Pioneer Venus mission, which was the last U.S. mission that actually entered a probe into the atmosphere of Venus. And I'm dating myself now, but that probe went in 1979. and that's literally the last time we've had other spacecraft to Venus since then, but the last time we actually entered into the atmosphere with instruments was that long ago. And one of my first research experiences as a student was helping on some work that using some data from that spacecraft, trying to understand the history of Venus and whether or not it was similar to Earth. And it was really hard to tell at that point because the data just wasn't that good. This was before the Magellan mission went and mapped the surface of Venus. So we didn't even know if Venus had, you know, things that looked like continents and ocean basins. And I mean, we knew it was really hot on the surface, but we didn't know much about the geology of the planet at all. So that was really my first time getting the Venus bug, was an early experience of research when I was a student. And, you know, even back then it was captivating to me the fact that this was a planet that in some ways was very much like Earth, in some ways the most like Earth of any planet we know, and yet clearly it had evolved in a completely different direction to being a dramatically different kind of place.
Yeah, and Venus is it's a strange place. It's got all kinds of interesting things. Let's do a little Venus 101, and I'll ask you some questions and you can educate us, okay?
Sure.
So let's start out with its location in the solar system. It's closer to the sun than we are, and as you mentioned, very hot. But that really doesn't have anything to do with why it's so hot on Venus, does it?
Well, I mean, in a way it does, but it's more complex than just put it closer to the sun and it heats up. I mean, that's part of it, but it has much more to do with the way the two planets have evolved. Just to give people the general picture, Venus is about three quarters the distance from the sun to the Earth. So, you know, if you picture, you know, I'm in the room I'm in now, I'm putting my hands, a meter apart from each other. And then I move one of them three quarters or one quarter of the way closer to the other one. And that's the difference between the Earth sun and the Venus sun distance. But the thing to remember is, because the amount of radiation goes up more steeply. We call it an inverse square law, but something that's 3/4 of the distance to the sun will have twice the radiation of Earth. So Venus gets about twice the solar radiation of Earth, but it's not straightforward why it's so much hotter there, because Venus is covered with clouds, so it reflects most of the solar radiation. So it actually doesn't get that much sunlight through those clouds. And the real reason it's hot, as I think you were intimating, Dave, is because of a super, super strong greenhouse effect. The atmosphere is mostly carbon dioxide, really thick atmosphere, and that just traps all of the heat radiation in a process that we're pretty familiar with talking about climate change here on Earth. We know a little bit of CO2 here on Earth causes a concerning greenhouse effect. Well, now imagine you have an Earth-sized planet where the atmosphere is all CO2, which is basically Venus, and that's why it's so extremely hot there.
Yeah, it's like 900 degrees Fahrenheit, hotter than, you know, your kitchen oven on broil.
That's right. And day, night, pole, equator, it's all that hot. Everywhere on Venus is just extremely, extremely hot.
Well, it also has some interesting orbital elements to it. For example, its day and its year are kind of backwards. Can you explain that?
Yeah, so Venus rotates on its axis extremely slowly. You know, so that's, you know, we think of the length of the day on Earth as 24 hours, and then there's 365 of those in a year. But Venus rotates so slowly. Well, for one thing, it rotates backwards compared to the Earth. So if you were on Venus, you would see the sun rise in the west and set in the east. If you could see the sun.
you can't because it's all cloudy,
but it goes the other way. But also it rotates so slowly that actually its year length, the time it takes to orbit around the sun, is shorter than its day length. So it's kind of a strange place in that regards, but its backwards rotating days are such that a day takes longer than a year on Venus.
And do we have any ideas of why that is, why Venus has this weird rotation?
We do have ideas about it, but we don't have solid proof that those ideas are right or wrong. We've come to understand that the rotation of the planets is often dominated by the giant collisions that happen during the formation of the planets. So, for example, Earth has its rotation and its large moon because of a big collision that happened late in the formation of the Earth that both set it spinning and splashed the stuff into orbit that made the moon. And then actually Earth has been slowing down its rotation over time because of the exchanging momentum with the moon. And as the moon recedes, the Earth slows down. So Earth's rotation is also very strange. But Venus probably got spinning backwards, I mean, compared to the other planets anyways, backwards, originally because of giant collisions that happened early in its history. And, you know, that's a hard thing to verify, especially because we've barely been to Venus with missions. And even if you did go there and picked up rocks and looked around, it's hard to verify a collision that happened billions of years ago. But that's the most promising idea. But it's also more complicated because, just as I mentioned, Earth's rotation rate has evolved over time. Probably Venus's has too, not because of moons, but because its very, very thick atmosphere has tidal effects on the planet over time. And it's probably changed its rotation and perhaps slowed down because of exchanging momentum, angular momentum, with that very thick atmosphere and tides that result from the sun's attraction on the atmosphere. So there's a lot of complex effects, and we have ideas about it, but we don't have a proven explanation of Venus's strange rotation.
All right, well, let's talk about these exciting new missions that were just announced. And there were many proposals to explore, like Io, the volcanic moon of Jupiter, and there's some fascinating missions planned. And yet, both of these missions, Da Vinci Plus and Veritas, which I'm hoping you can talk about both of them a little bit, for Venus were selected. And it's been a long time, as you mentioned, since Venus got any attention at all. So I'm just wondering, you know, how surprised were you and excited? How did you find out that, that these missions were funded?
It's hard for me to even explain how excited and thrilled I am about this, because this is literally a quest I've been on through my whole career and, you know, most of my adult life, not just years, but decades. I've been part of teams pushing for new Venus missions. And it's been a long time since the U.S. has launched a mission to Venus. You know, 1989 was the last time was when we launched Magellan. Other countries have done Venus missions since then, but it's been a long time for us. And, you know, I also want to mention, because you mentioned the other missions in competition, that even as I express my joy about this, I want to acknowledge that these were all good candidate missions, and it's very hard for the teams that have lost out. And I wish them well. And I know that the Io mission and the Triton mission that were in the finals along with us, those are worthy projects. Those are missions that ought to fly. And I think they will in the future. And I really do understand that pain of losing out, because I've been in that situation so many times. I've literally been on a dozen or more proposals for Venus missions that have not been selected by NASA. And each time it's intense and painful, because you put years into these proposals with a team of scientists and engineers, and you get psyched up and you think that you've got a decent chance. And so this time there were two Venus missions that made the finals. And we thought, people were saying, well, two Venus missions that have made the finals, at least one of them is going to get selected this time. And a few of us said, you know, they could both get selected. I mean, it's been a long time for Venus, and these two missions, Da Vinci Plus and Veritas, are not, there's no overlap between them. They're very complementary. They do different things. And so some of us dared fantasize, what if NASA is bold and brave and says, let's start a Venus program and let's select both these missions? It could happen. But it seemed like, you know, kind of that it would be too good to be true, but we harbored wishes for that. And that's, of course, what happened. We found out just a little over a week ago that was the choice that NASA made. And as far as you're asking me, you know, how I actually found out, well, I mean, they really keep it under wraps. I literally didn't know until the day of the selection. And there was a press conference that afternoon, and I did get tipped off, you know, a couple hours before that press conference. A colleague, texted me and said, you're never going to believe this. They selected both. There were a few hours of some of us in the know, you know, but that was it. You know, it's not like we knew for days and days and we're keeping it under wraps. They really kept it tight. And boy, what an experience for the Venus community, because, you know, we've been sort of feel like we've been, you know, wandering in the desert for a long time, and now it's raining.
Well, and you've been such an advocate for the exploration of Venus. Give us your elevator speech. Why? What makes Venus such a fascinating place that you think it really deserves these explorations?
Well, it's literally the closest planet to Earth, the closest other planet to Earth. I mean, Venus and Mars depend on where in the orbit they are, which is closest at any given time. But Venus is the planet that comes closest to Earth. And in some ways, it's the most similar planet. It's exactly or almost exactly the same size as Earth, which is remarkable considering the huge range of planet sizes. They're really twins. And it seems as though, from what we can tell, they started out very similar. So it's almost like you have this pair of identical twin planets, and then they've evolved in such different directions. So it's this big mystery. Why did this planet that seems to have started off so Earth-like end up such an inferno, such a dried-out inferno? What happened to Venus, and what does that tell us about how Earth-like planets evolve? So I feel like there's a ton of information there about, not just Venus as an interesting object in itself, but sort of cracking the mystery of how planets get to be the way they are, including how our Earth got to be the way it is. So in sort of an overall sense, it's like this alternative Earth that went down a very different direction. But there are a lot more specific questions could there have been life on Venus? I think there could have been, because from what we understand, it probably had an early environment very similar to Earth's early environment when life was forming. And so did life form on Venus? And then how long, if it did, how long did it last? And recent models suggest Venus could have been Earth-like for a long time. So there could have even been the evolution of complex life there. And there could have been this other planet right next door that was living for a long time. And then finally, we want to know what happened. It clearly, Venus sort of broke bad. It lost its oceans, if it ever had them. We think it did. What was that process? How did it lose its oceans? How did the climate get so extreme? And what does that have to tell us about climate change, including climate change on Earth? And how does that help us put in context how Earth fits into to all the planets in the universe, you know, as far as why climates evolve the way they do and how we can better predict climate change on our own planet by understanding climate change elsewhere? You know, these are some of the mysteries. You know, a lot of it has to do with just the comparisons to Earth, which are so compelling to me that it is so similar in some ways and then has evolved in such a dramatically different way.
Let's take a short break, but when we return, we'll continue our conversation with David Grinspoon about Da Vinci Plus and Veritas, NASA's newly funded missions to the planet Venus. Stay with us. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Let's return now to our conversation with planetary scientist David Grinspoon as we discuss NASA's plans for two future missions to study the planet Venus. Let's talk about the name of the spacecraft, Da Vinci Plus, which is an amazing name and the acronym that goes with it, Deep Atmosphere Venus Investigation of Noble Gases, Chemistry, and Imaging. Well, there's one part of it that I find really intriguing, and that's the noble gases part. Why noble gases? What is important about them?
So the noble gases, if you look in the, you know, everybody knows the periodic table of the elements from their science classroom in high school, you know, which starts with hydrogen in the upper left and so forth. And if you look over on the very right side, very right column, on the periodic table of the elements, you get the noble gases, which are, you know, helium, neon, argon, krypton, xenon. And what makes them noble gases is that they don't react with anything. They do not participate in chemistry, which is, you know, you could say makes them, they could be called the snobby gases. They don't consort with other elements. But what that means is that their history preserves a lot of information that other gases don't, because they haven't participated in all these exchanges that the other gases have. So if you've added noble gas to the atmosphere of a planet at some time in the past, it's, you know, still there. Or if it's escaped, it's left a signature of that escape, because we have the what we call the isotopes, which are the different masses within those elements that that fractionate. That is, they escape at different rates depending on what's happening with the atmosphere. So anyways, this is a long-winded way to say that because these gases do not participate in chemistry, unlike all the other elements in the periodic table, that it's easier to relate, to understand, if you measure their amounts and their ratios very carefully, it contains a lot of information about the origin and the evolution of the atmosphere that other elements don't contain. And the noble gases We know them very well for Earth. We know them very well for Mars. They've been measured. We've never measured the noble gases with any accuracy on Venus. So it's a source of information that we know we can measure with this, with the instruments on Da Vinci Plus, that is just waiting there for us to tell us stories about the history of this planet.
Okay, and can you tell us a little bit about the other mission that's been funded, Veritas, which is kind of interesting because that's Latin for truth. Venus Emissivity Radio Science, INSAR Topography and Spectroscopy. That's another one of those acronyms. Tell us about, you said this mission is very complementary to Da Vinci. Tell us why.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost as if the two are so complementary that you could have designed them as elements of an overall program, which is what they're going to be now, though they were not designed that way. We've been in competition with the other mission. But they're both wonderful, and it's just thrilling that we're going to get to do both now, because they're sort of opposite. Da Vinci drops a probe into the atmosphere and gets very specific information about one place on Venus, what the atmosphere is like, and then descends towards the surface and takes images of one spot on the surface. So we'll get detailed images of one place and a detailed trace of one part of the atmosphere. Veritas does almost the opposite. It doesn't go into the atmosphere. It stays in orbit. But as it orbits the planet, it has a radar mapper and an infrared mapper, and it makes very detailed maps of the entire planet from orbit. So you have this one spacecraft, which is going to enter into one place in the atmosphere and tell you exactly what the atmosphere is made of and get very close up images of one place on the surface. And you will have another spacecraft that's going to stay in orbit and map the entire planet, which is amazing, because then you think of like how much more valuable that one, the data from Da Vinci will be when we have those global maps and can completely put it in context. And at the same time, the Da Vinci data will help us interpret the Veritas data, because we'll know exactly what the images of one spot on the surface look like, which will help us interpret all the rest of that global mapping. So I'm really excited the sort of sum of the two parts is going to be so much greater than the whole is going to be so much greater than the sum of the parts for these missions.
Yeah, and I saw that the Europeans just announced they're going to do a mission to Venus too. What can you tell us briefly about what's that going to do?
Oh man, yeah, that's Envision. When it rains, it pours. It's Venus month here on Earth. So that's another mission that's been in competition for quite some time. And Envision, it also has a radar mapper, somewhat like Veritas, but it's a higher resolution mapper, and it doesn't map the entire surface. It maps particular areas in greater precision, greater resolution. So it's actually a marvelous complement to Veritas's global mapping. Plus, it has some other instruments with which it can actually measure the subsurface. Has a radar instrument that can look for structures underneath the ground with a different wavelength than Veritas has. And it also has some, it's an orbiter, and it has some other instruments that can measure the properties of the very diffuse gases that are escaping from the planet up there in the in orbit, which help us understand how the atmosphere is losing gases and help us, again, sort of constrain the evolution of the planet. So, you know, again, all three of these missions, none of them are redundant. None of them are overlapping with the others. And all of a sudden we've gone from being the community that always wishes we had missions and always complains that we get overlooked to now we have an international flotilla of missions heading to Venus.
Well, it seems appropriate since, you know, Venus has this runaway greenhouse effect and a climate gone just horribly wrong. And here on our planet, we're doing this insane experiment on our climate that's not going very well. It seems like the appropriate time for this to happen.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, of course, I've been saying that for quite some time. It's time for Venus. But I feel like the awareness of just what you're saying, of how relevant it is for some of the things we really worry about here on Earth, like Are we sure we understand everything that we can about climate change? And there's some very specific aspects of climate change that we could really get help from studying other planets. Like one of the things that, you know, we don't do very well with climate change on Earth is understanding the role of clouds. Clouds are tricky and they're hard to include in climate models. So that's one thing that's great about Venus. It's covered with clouds. And through these missions, we can learn more about the role that clouds are playing in climate there. And then that comes back and gives us sort of a reality check for how well we're doing, including clouds in our climate models here. So yeah, the time has come. I think people realize that for us to, you know, just take advantage of the fact that that all of that information and all these mysteries is hiding right there. But another thing that really helped us was that, you know, that we know there are exoplanets, planets around other stars, which, of course, we didn't know in 1989, the last time we launched a Venus mission. And a lot of people that study exoplanets are very interested in Venus because they realize if we want to understand the variations we're seeing in planets around other stars, we have to really understand the variation in planets around our own star. And the Venus-Earth difference is a really interesting one for people studying exoplanets because, you know, we're just on the verge of being able to make new observations of planets around other stars. And we want to know when should we expect to see an exo-Earth and when should we expect to see an exo-Venus? You know, what is it that makes them go down these different paths? And so some of the new support that's come along for Venus missions actually comes from the growing community of scientists who are now studying exoplanets and wanting to know exactly how the story of our solar system fits into the story of all these other solar systems we're discovering.
Huh? Well, that makes sense. I would like to ask what's next, like what's the timeline? When are these missions going to actually be launched? And when are you going to be able to start getting data from Venus? How far down the road is that?
Well, the timeline is a little bit in flux now because these selections were just made by NASA, but it's looking like probably Veritas will launch in 2028 and Da Vinci Plus will launch in 2029, which, you know, may sound like a long time to some of your listeners, but for those of us that have been working on these missions, you know that we have a launch date and now we can just get going on building and assembling and, you know, getting ready to fly the spacecraft, it feels like, hey, that's coming right up. and then there's a private company, a company called Rocket Labs, a small rocket company in New Zealand that has announced that they're going to be sending a small Venus mission. And they say they're going to launch in 2023, which would be really cool. You know, it'd be a much less smaller and less capable spacecraft than these NASA ones we're talking about. But nonetheless, it would be, you know, amazing if they could demonstrate that they're able to do that. And, you know, any new data about Venus from anywhere would be very welcome by the international scientific community. So we'll see. And then there are even other countries that are talking about, you know, the Russians have a possible Venus mission. The Indian Space Agency is talking about a possible mission in the future. So, you know, as of now, there are three definite missions that are going to be launching. And, you know, we'll see. Maybe Venus seems to be something that's catching on.
Yeah. Well, again, congratulations on these missions being selected, because I know it's of great importance to you. And thanks for talking to us about it.
Oh, thanks a lot. It's always a pleasure. And yeah, we're pretty psyched.
Thanks to our guest, David Grinspoon from the Planetary Science Institute. We're going to take a short break, but stay with us because up next, we're going to talk to Paul Chodas, one of the world's foremost experts on the orbits of comets and asteroids, about a recent simulation of how the world could respond to an impact that's imminent. Stay with us. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Next, we return our attention to the threat of collisions from space, which, as you may know, was very bad news for the dinosaurs. As the saying goes, they didn't have a space program, but we do. And one of the people in charge of keeping track of all the orbiting debris from the creation of the solar system is Paul Chodas. He's the head of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory's Center for Near-Earth Object Studies in Pasadena. Paul was part of a recent international effort to simulate how the Earth could respond to an imminent asteroid impact, and he joined us recently to talk about it. Paul Chodas, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I got really interested in contacting you because I saw this tabletop exercise to look at simulating an asteroid impact, and I noticed that this isn't the first time you guys have done this. Can you tell me a bit about the history of doing these kinds of things?
Yeah, this was at the Planetary Defense Conference, which is held every 2 years. And we've done this for the last five conferences, as I recall. And we've done it a few times also with other agencies in the U.S. government. So NASA cooperating with FEMA, for example, to just to go through the exercises.
And I would imagine very similar to like when the state of California does the Great Shakeout to simulate a large earthquake on the San Andreas Fault. There's multiple purposes to this, to look at how agencies can work together and what kinds of things you can learn. Is that what this is really kind of all about?
Yes, that's right. It's really instructive for the whole community, not just those of us on the NASA side, but also emergency response communities and things, groups like that.
And okay, so let's go through this. I saw this was kind of interesting. The way this is simulated over the days of your conference, the simulation starts on April 19th with the discovery of this mythical object. It doesn't really exist. Asteroid 2021 PDC. And I'm assuming that what's the PDC stand for?
That's the Planetary Defense Conference. So it's kind of named after the conference that we present it at.
Yeah, so you can make sure people know this is fictitious.
Totally hypothetical and made up, yes.
Yeah. And so tell us about the name Pan-STARRS, because I know what it means, but a lot of our listeners won't.
That's one of NASA's funded asteroid surveys. So that's a real thing. It's in Hawaii. They have two quite large telescopes that scan the dark skies every night searching for asteroids. So I kind of, as the designer of this exercise, I weave in some realism, and they are a real survey discovering lots of real asteroids.
So as of April 19th, what do you guys know?
So that was the discovery date that, you know, in this hypothetical case. And on a discovery, what really happens is the telescope takes pictures of the sky, which is what they do regularly every night. And they come back several times to the same region of sky, and they'll see what moves over the course of about an hour in that region of the sky. And so there's automatic algorithms, you know, computers that find the moving objects. And this one would be reported as being a moving object. The asteroids just look like points of light, so you can't really tell them apart from stars just by looking at them. You have to see, they're kind of detected by the fact that they move. So that's how asteroid detection is done routinely, and that's how it would be done in this case. Now, I customized this so that, you know, the asteroid was just getting bright enough on that date that it could be discovered by that telescope.
So on that date, though, there's no inkling that this thing could impact Earth, right?
Yeah, with the way it works. And by the way, this happens like every night. And we get, you know, we come into the office in the morning at our Center for NEO Studies, and there'll be like a dozen new asteroids found in the previous night. I mean, that's how many are being found nowadays. And what we routinely do is, well, first of all, they have to be followed up enough. That is to say, there has to be other telescopes looking at it and confirming that this is, you know, a real thing and not some artifact in the image. But once it's confirmed, it goes into our databases, and that's what would happen in this hypothetical case. And then we would notice that we would do an orbit, calculate the orbit, and we would notice, oh, this orbit gets close to the Earth. You know, could it hit? Now, with only a night or two, you can't really be sure at all that it could hit, but you could know that the orbit comes close to the Earth. Now, in our scenario, I actually set this up so that over a course of a few days, our systems would get a better and better orbit, because you don't just take four pictures of it on one night, you keep tracking it. And so as you add more and more information, you get better and better orbits. And so the impact probability from day to day to day would start creeping up in our calculations. Okay. And so we would start getting more and more worried about this object. And the way I set up this scenario and this exercise was that by, you know, 10 days later, on that first day of the conference, by the way, the impact probability has reached 5%. So the chance that this asteroid could hit the Earth was 5%. And we could even figure out the date of that, which would have been, I think it was in October. So 6 months, you know, in the future. So that's a worrisome scenario. And that's the intent. That's by design. You know, that's what we want to do. And so 5% would be then presented to the community and the public and the decision makers. And we would have to start making decisions on what to do.
And then in the scenario on May 2nd, you are refining the orbit and starting to get more and more data collected. So what do you know then?
Yeah, you do it continuously as long as the sky is dark. Now, as often happens in reality, the moon gets in the way. And so there's like breaks. You can't see it every night, but you would gather more data. And in our scenario, I took a realistic twist by designing this so that there was data that discovered in archives, Ooh. Image archives from Pan-STARRS from 7 years earlier. So, of course, these telescopes are taking images of the sky every night, and they accumulate terabytes and terabytes of data in the images. And it's quite possible that an asteroid could have been in an image on a previous pass by the Earth years earlier, but was too faint to be detected by these algorithms that you know, that look for moving objects. But if you know the orbit of an object and you run it back 7 years, you could actually kind of stack the images and amplify the where it should be, more or less, and then see where it really was. And then that becomes a kind of a put a pin in that point in the orbit. And then suddenly you know whether or not the asteroid is going to hit or not. And in this case, yes, it was going to hit. The probability went to 100% using these archival images from 7 years ago.
So then in the scenario from discovery in April to May, it's in May that you know that it's going to hit?
Yeah. So, I mean, that's typical also because after a week or so of tracking an object, you get its orbit to be able to predict where it was 7 years earlier. And then, you know, it may or may not have been seen earlier. In this case, we said, yes, it was. And then that enables you to us to compute a much better orbit and 100%.
And then the next thing I saw was that in June, on June 30th, you're starting to get a handle on the size parameters of this thing. That at the largest, it's like 500 meters across, I think I saw, and at the smallest, 35 meters. Could you give us a sense of both ends of the spectrum there? Like what kind of kinetic energy, what kind of impact scenario are you looking at with a 500-meter object and then compare that to a smaller object? You know, what are we looking at? Bookend this for me.
Well, I forget the numbers, but it's orders of magnitude in terms of the energy of the impact. So it's a huge difference. What we were getting at with that point of the exercise was the fact that when an asteroid is discovered, we really don't know how bright it, how big it is. All we know is how bright it is on the sky. And how bright it is isn't good enough to tell you its real size, because you don't know how dark the surface is and how much it's reflecting. You don't know critical things like that. So if you use a typical range of reflectivities of asteroids, it could be as dark as coal. In fact, this asteroid that we're bringing samples back from is a very dark asteroid, Bennu, the OSIRIS-REx spacecraft. That's a very dark asteroid. Or it could be average brightness, or it could be actually pretty bright. So since you don't know, but you know how bright it is, that maps into kind of how big it is. You really don't know. It could be small as like 50 meters, I think it was, on one, if it was really a bright asteroid, or on the other end, it could be, if it's really, really dark, it could be, you know, 700 meters in size. So that's a huge uncertainty. So the exercise kind of transitioned from not knowing whether it would hit the Earth and uncertainty in its orbital parameters. And then we that problem was solved, but then we still have the problem of how big it is. And then if you don't know how big it is, you don't know how much energy it would release when it hits the Earth. So orders of magnitude in energy, I think it went up to gigatons in the energy level if it was really big. And that could, be hazardous and destroy a large area on the Earth, maybe, a large region, if it's really big and the energy is in gigatons. On the other hand, if it's small, it would it could even burn up mostly in the atmosphere and you just have shock waves. So you see it varies completely. And we're kind of pushing on that point that we need to characterize the size. Now, and what we did in this case was we had a space-based infrared satellite that's still orbiting. It observed this hypothetical asteroid, and that could constrain the size a little bit if it was just barely detectable from in the infrared. We can't do that from the ground. We need an infrared spacecraft doing that. So that was what we put in the exercise at that point, but it only constrained it to 500 meters, in the worst case. So we had to deal with the possibility it could be that large.
Wow. And then at these early points, it's going to hit Earth, but you don't really know where. I was looking at a Google Earth image and there were, potential impact points all over the hemisphere of the Earth.
Yes.
And then finally you zero it in and you decide you got a 99% certainty that it's going to hit in the area of Germany and the Czech Republic and Austria. Like how do you figure that out?
Well, that's the that's all from the orbit, and that's what we do kind of routinely. In fact, we've done that for real asteroids, little guys. We've had a few tiny asteroids that we've seen in space and tracked them. This I'm thinking of one that happened in 2008 and impacted in Sudan. And as we track it, the orbit improves, and we can pinpoint where it will hit. For our exercise, this asteroid was a little farther out and harder to track accurately, but eventually we would know where it's going to hit.
And what was the impact was October 20th or something like that would be when it would hit?
That's right. Yeah, in this case. Yeah, that's right. So this is made up, and I picked a date that was about 6 months from when it was first discovered, because that was when we as a group decided how we're going to do this exercise, that was one of the first things to decide. What is the warning time? 6 months is really pretty short. If you're trying to defend the planet and deflect the asteroid and things like that. And I saw news articles about how NASA failed to protect us from this impact in our exercise. But that was by design. That's kind of what we're pushing at in this with this exercise, is to ask what we would do with short warning in terms of emergency response on the ground.
And of course, you'd have to evacuate a large area, in Europe there if something like that were to happen. And that could happen someday. So that's interesting.
It could. Now, previous exercises, we've had a longer warning time. Let's take, the one 2 years ago, we had, I think, an 8-year warning time. And that allows us, the whole community, to study it in greater detail. And we could actually have a campaign of missions to study the asteroid and determine its size accurately and determine it whether or not it's going to hit and where it's going to hit, and also deflect it by, hitting it with kinetic impact or spacecraft, we call them, that kind of ram it a little bit. And that has to be done years before the potential impact. You can't just do that at the last minute, because you're only changing the velocity just a little bit. And if you do that, let's say 2 or 3 years before it could hit, that little change in velocity is going to make it miss the Earth. And so, you know, a successful deflection is what we had in the previous exercise 2 years ago.
When did you start your work at JPL and your studies of near Earth objects? How long have you been at this?
Gosh, a long time. It's 40 years, about 40 years.
So I'm going to ask you a difficult question then. Can you, you know, in a, as briefly as you can you tell us about how our understanding of near Earth objects and these impact, you know, scenarios, probabilities, and our understanding of what, how many near our Earth objects there are that orbit around Earth, how that's evolved during your career there to what we know now from where, when you started?
It's evolved tremendously, thank goodness. Back 30 years ago, we knew that there was a hazard here. You just look at planets and look at the moon and you see craters. So obviously, in the past, there have been a lot of asteroids, you know, that rammed the moon and made craters. Now, that was all in the early solar system, so the impact rate has dropped off, but we still knew that there was a hazard, let's put it that way. And the smartest thing to do to solve this problem is just to look and find them and catalog them and figure out whether an impact, however unlikely, whether or not there's a big one heading our way. So this program started up 25 years ago or so, and NASA started funding search programs to search for these objects. And the asteroid Bennu, for example, was found as a result of one of these NASA search programs in the late 90s, in fact. So we've kind of been chipping away and finding all the big ones. We're actually, I think, at over 95% of the total population of big ones. We know where they all are. We've done all our calculations. They're not headed for the Earth in the next couple centuries. So we're safe from those ones. And then our goalposts moved to find smaller ones down to about 500 feet across, 140 meters. And that size range, we still has a lot of work to be done. Those are harder to find because they're fainter, but we've made progress on that. I think we found around 35 or 40% of those ones that would pose a lesser hazard, not an extinction level event like the big ones, but still a hazard. And so we've made a tremendous progress in finding these objects. And that's the key. You want to find them with a lot of warning time.
Yeah. And there's been some kind of famous ones like Apophis, the asteroid that I, you know, heard about for many, many years. And we know now, based on what I saw on your website, that we're safe from that for quite a while. Is that correct?
That's right. That was a very hazardous asteroid when it was first discovered in 2004, and we didn't know its orbit very accurately. And when we predicted it 25 years into the future, we saw that it could come really close to the Earth in the year 2029, and so close that, you know, it could hit. And so the impact probability, just as in our scenarios, the impact probability, as we got more data, was creeping up and up and up. But as often happens, you get more and more data, and eventually the uncertainty shrinks, and the Earth is no longer within that, you know, cone of possibility for the 2029 passage. So then we could be sure that yes, it's going to miss that year. But then orbits are orbits, and if an asteroid passes by the Earth once, that means it could pass by many times in the future. So we've then started checking possible future chances that Apophis could impact. And for a while there, it could hit in 2036. And eventually we refined the orbit enough with radar and other methods to say, no, it's going to miss in 2036, but then it might hit in 2068 and that sort of thing. Well, the news this year is that we finally refined the orbit well enough to know that it can't hit really any time in the next century. And so it's kind of removed from the list of possible impacting asteroids. It was one of the more concerning ones, though, for a long time, because it's fairly large.
Yeah.
It's like 1,000 feet or something across.
And before I let you go, as we're about out of time here, we are out of time, but can you give us like the big picture takeaway? What's the main takeaway from this exercise you did?
It kind of by design, we understood that 6 months is really a very short warning time. If you're talking about deflecting an asteroid or disrupting it, and that's something that I hope is a message that gets across. I saw public news stories, you know, that NASA failed to deflect the asteroid. Well, that was because 6 months is just not enough time to mount a mission and deflect an asteroid. So that was one clear message. Other messages, pre-recovery data, which is like that data that you find in the archives. So you want to keep your archives of data, and maybe a threatening asteroid is lurking there and you won't know until you discover it, you know, in a future year, things like that. And finally, the size issue. We really don't know an asteroid size when it's first discovered. And there are the ways to find the size, are really radar or send a mission. Those are the two best ways. Now, radar, in this case, the asteroid didn't come within radar range, so that wasn't possible. But if you really want to know how big an asteroid is, and it is headed for the Earth, and you want to know how big an area to evacuate and all of these things, or how much oomph you need to deflect it, you need to have a reconnaissance mission sent out there, find out how big it is, and hopefully how massive it is. And that's really an essential part. And it was in this exercise as well.
Well, Paul Chodas, director for NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory Center for Near-Earth Object Studies, thanks for sharing this experience that you guys had with us. And I appreciate the fact that you're on the job keeping track of what's out there.
Yeah, thank you, Dave, for having me.
Thanks again to our guests, David Grinspoon from the Planetary Science Institute and member of the Da Vinci Plus mission to study Venus, and Paul Chodas from NASA's Center for Near-Earth Object Studies based at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of CAP Radio in beautiful and talented and very dry Northern California. You can share this program or check out past episodes and subscribe to our podcast at mynspr.org, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music is by Matt Schiltz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fiddler. Our associate producer and owner of a dog named Rocket is Ellie Johnson. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.